Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland.
On News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof, the podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. I'm Jonathan McRae. Thank you for downloading, subscribing and rating. We start the programme, as always, looking back at some of the breaking stories from the world of science this week. We're joined by Dr. Tara Shine from Change by Degrees and Dr. Jessamine Fairfield from the University of Galway. You're both very welcome. Our first story, Jess, has to do with the power of exercise.
That's right. And this is a really, really interesting study about the power of exercise when you're recovering from cancer. Right. So as lots of people will know, there's the initial diagnosis and treatment of cancer. That's obviously a lot to get through. And then for those who are lucky enough to then become cancer free, the question is then, what do you do next? And how do you minimize your chances of cancer recurring? So there's been this huge new study release that was led by Queen's University in Ontario, Canada, following about 900 people who had been treated for colon cancer across three different continents. About 90% of them had stage three cancer, which is, you know, pretty serious. And half of the people in this group were then assigned to a three-year-long structured exercise program. So basically, this meant that, you know, they weren't just told to exercise, as we all always are. They were actually given a personal trainer two times a month and you know, accountability to that trainer. The other half received educational materials about health. But for the exercise group, they were really aiming for like a pretty serious level of exercise, looking to take about 45 to 60 minute brisk walks, about four per week, or looking at other forms of activity. And what the study found is that 8 years later, those who were in the exercise group actually experienced 28% fewer recurrences of their cancer and 37% fewer deaths overall. So this means that about of this total group, 90% of those who exercised stayed cancer-free and about 74% of those who didn't stayed cancer-free. So still most people staying cancer-free, but this is actually quite a big increase in the difference between the control and the exercise intervention group. The research group presenting it at a major conference this last week talked about how this is more effective than many drugs that are approved for post-cancer treatment, and it has fewer side effects. It's really an incredibly effective intervention, and it's really interesting to see this around exercise. I think the personal trainer aspect of it, I think, is really important, because sometimes when there are studies done on exercise, you know, we can rely on self-reporting of exercise. Sometimes that's a little bit aspirational. Sometimes you wish you were the sort of person that went on a run three times a week, and maybe you're more of a weekend warrior. But I think it's interesting in this context that with that support, there was such a huge difference in cancer recurrence.
That is very impressive. And it does take, it does take willpower, it does take resilience. But I guess if you're looking at those sort of statistics and you want to live or be cancer free, it's a real no brainer. And I guess it's really important in this environment where we're being bombarded with lots of misinformation about cancer.
That's right. So there was actually another study that came out at the same academic conference this past week talking about misinformation aimed at cancer patients and how it's risen sharply over the last 10 years. This is largely driven by social media, which is actually very important in terms of like cancer patients finding community with each other. But unfortunately, it also provides this platform for people promoting treatments that don't necessarily have systematic evidence supporting them. And it's crazy to me if you think about people who, you know, understandably are worried about having or having had cancer, looking for something that can provide a bit of hope. And there are people on all these platforms looking, saying stuff about like juicing or enemas or vitamin infusions. And you have, you know, A, medical treatment, but also things like exercise, which can actually do a huge amount of good. I think it really just underscores the importance of looking for information from trusted sources, right? Like your GP, your oncologist, or places like the HSE.
Absolutely. And, you know, of all the crap that is swirling around our world at the moment, the one real shining light is cancer survival rates and cancer success stories. Like in the last 15, 20 years, we've made such gains on this horrific disease. So there are better and better medications available. Stay away from the social media if you're trying to deal with something like cancer, would be my recommendation.
Yeah, following the science saves a lot of lives here.
Yeah. Tara, our second story has to do with brain training for pain.
It does. And looking at whether a game that trains your brain to fire differently can be an alternative pain treatment to even opioids. So I think this is really exciting because they've designed this. This is research from Professor Sylvia Augustin. So she's one of these leading researchers on the brain's thalamus, which is like that central hub of your brain that controls everything. And she's trying to see if in better understanding like the neurological pathways and the waves that transmit, whether there's ways that we can treat pain for people at home without a reliance on often quite very expensive medication. And so she's discovered that the brain waves of people who are in pain are different to the brain waves of people without pain. And her whole question is there a way to normalize those brain patterns? And the way that they're doing it is by connecting up a game, a video game that the person suffering from the pain watches or interacts with. That's connected to an EEG. Here comes a really hard word to say, which is an electroencephalogram. Can either of you say that? Anyway, I find it very hard to say. But it's a sensor that goes on your head and that detects electrical brain activity. And so they've 3D printed one of these. So it's like cheaper and affordable. And so you're sitting there with your EEG on your head and you're watching a little octopus in the sea. And it's training your brain to think calm, cool thoughts. And when you do that, the sea turns a turquoise color and your brain gets a nice positive feedback loop. And when you're not doing so well, when you're not focused well, the sea goes back to being sort of a dark navy color. That seems to be like the guts of the game, which I find quite fascinating. But what they found, now this study is on 4 people only, but 3 out of 4 people that were using this new approach to managing their pain noticed equal, if not better, results than taking opioid drugs.
Which is, I mean, okay, let's just first off say that's a tiny amount of people to make any sort of medical claims, but certainly is one of those ones where it becomes something worth investigating because on the face of it, you go, oh my God, opioids are these, you know, famous class of drugs that are so powerful, they can be very addictive, but they're also known for really stopping pain in its tracks and then playing a game. But then you remember, as we've talked about on this show so many times, that pain, like all sensations, is created in the brain and that actually it's possible for us to have a leg that is bleeding out and for us not to feel anything because we create that sensation within the brain. And so it's really interesting, though, that something as simple as this and as something as I was thinking it would require some intense concentration, like playing Fortnite or something, would distract people from it. So certainly something to look at. But people, you know, when you look at Wim Hof and, you know, his exposure to cold and lots of people who do extraordinary feats that would ordinarily really hurt us, being able to temper and tamper with these pathways that signal pain to the brain is very possible.
Yeah. Yeah. And, I was really curious. I couldn't find out for a while what was the game. I was like, how complicated is the game? Is really simple. It's like literally this little octopus bobbing around on a page. And then as you get these color feedbacks as you calm your brain. So when people are coming into the experiment, they encourage them to kind of take themselves to a calm place so that they're kind of stabilizing the pathways before they commence. Anyway, I found it fascinating. And they make that point, look, it's for people, but it does show us that this is worth further investigation. And they're looking also for people with spinal injuries and spinal cord associated pain, how it can really help them. So there's loads of places they can take this.
Yeah, and I guess you also, it needs practice. I remember doing this exact test on stage, and I am someone whose brain does not rest, and I could not calm my brain down to get a similar game work. I just couldn't, like meditation does not work for me. So I need to figure that out, that's for sure. Our third story, Jessamine, is a really interesting one. It has to do with penguin poop and its effect on climate change.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, penguin poop is pretty gross. It is also ubiquitous.
Have you stepped on it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, look, if you ever see like a photo of a like beautiful, clean, black and white penguin, I guarantee you that penguin just came out of the water. They are filthy. They are filthy, filthy birds. And their poo is like actually bright pink.
You need to say dirty. They're dirty birds.
Like, basically, they eat so much of this Antarctic krill, they are just covered in this, like, pink poo. Like, you can see penguin colonies from space because of the poo. And you might think that is so gross. it's also really important. And this new study just came out of the University of Helsinki, where they basically found that, you know, penguin poo on the ground releases ammonia. Like, it releases so much ammonia that you will smell a penguin colony before you see it, because you'll be like, oh my God, what is that? Where are we going? But that ammonia actually interacts with sulfuric acid, which is released from marine phytoplankton at the coastal parts of Antarctica. And this allows it to create a compound that acts as a seed for cloud formation. So basically, areas that have penguins, like active penguin colonies, will have up to 1,000 times more ammonia in the atmosphere over them. And even a month after penguins leave, like as part of the migration, you will still get 100 times more ammonia because it's just coming off the ground for like ages. And of course, the wind is shifting. It's blowing around these ammonia and these other kind of aerosolized penguin compounds. And this is just boosting cloud formation rates over those areas by, this study found, up to 10,000 times. So, what? Yeah, which is crazy. Like, the penguins, and I can't overemphasize this, they stink, but they are an important part of the balance of the ecosystem in these areas. And it's actually this really interesting kind of interconnected network because, you know, as we know, penguins are losing habitats due to sea ice loss from global warming. But then the decline in penguins could lead to further decline in ice, right? If there are fewer clouds being created from this penguin poo to protect ice from the sun. So I guess it's one of the most important poo stories that I've ever heard. And it's just a really interesting way that even this horrible, disgusting thing about penguins is actually really important.
Hmm. We did a story about whale poo and the nutrients it provides a few weeks ago. That was also reasonably important. But it just goes to show, you know, one man's waste, another man's treasure, and so on. Our final story, Tara, is quite a funny one. It's to do with following rules. This sounds like a very British study.
It is. It's from the University of Nottingham. But they did a survey of, so they did a study on 14,000 people. So a big survey size this time. Again, sitting at a computer. So it was a computer game to test how well people would follow rules. But there was no penalty. There was a minor penalty for not following the rules. But really, nobody was looking at them. There was no major external consequence.
What sort of a game was it? Sorry, Tara. What sort of game were they playing?
Oh, it was this game around a traffic light, and you had to wait for the traffic light to go green to pass from point A to B. And then from after that, you had to kind of leg it to get to the end line, right? So it was fairly simple rules. It doesn't sound like it was very sophisticated. And what they found was that people aren't always motivated to stick to rules because of what they call extrinsic incentives or consequences. So people aren't always sticking to rules because they're a social norm or because there's a direct negative consequence on not following the rules. Some people, a quarter of people, love rules. And this makes total sense to me. Think of the people you know in your life who love rules, who really hate it when other people don't abide by the rules. And who,
the entire country of Switzerland.
But also, I don't think of your family, think of your expanded, like everybody knows somebody who just really is like at sea when rules aren't there. So there's something more, which is like there's an intrinsic value of rules to people. And some people really need those rules and they respect the whole notion of rules and norms guiding society. Mm. Much more so than the fact that there might be a penalty or a consequence for not abiding by them. And the whole point of the survey is, well, this whole study is, well, what does that mean for lawmaking and for the types of nudges and policy incentives that governments create to get people to change behaviors and do things differently? Because not everybody needs the same thing.
What about socioeconomic factors? Like, did they affect people's willingness to follow the rules? Because I would imagine there's some sort of correlation between your willingness to follow rules and your happiness with where you are in your socioeconomic status. I can imagine, you know, when I think of stereotypical rule followers, it's, you know, I hate to say this, but I'm thinking of Protestant mums and Swiss people tend to love rules and following this and being, you know, following these things. I would imagine that's generally because they're doing okay. Is that a terrible besmirching? It might be.
I think so. I think it's more intrinsic to us. So they did, you know, they did mix up the game and provide different kinds of punishments and incentives. But for those people who intrinsically believe in the rules, nothing will dissuade them from the rules. Mm. So I think this has also got to do with our wonderful neurodiversity. So when I think about it like that more than in types of religion or countries, I guess, in that there's certain types of neurodiversity that really feel safer and less anxious when the rules are clear, when the rules, societal rules are clear, when they know what to expect. And that gives some people a really great respect for the rules and for justice and fairness, which is, you know, also something which, for example, autistic people have a great sense of fairness and love rules, because that's one leads to the other.
Yeah.
And so that might be an absolute intrinsic respect and love of rules, which it doesn't matter what the external factors are that you change, that remains a sort of a guiding light in your life. So I think it tells us more about the fact that people are diverse in their motivations.
And just to say that I realize I've fallen into an absolute stereotype trap there. I'm sure there are lots of wild Protestant mums out there, but as a parent of a child who goes to a Protestant school, there's lots of rules there, and I fail at following all of them badly. And it seems like everyone else around me manages to do exactly the right thing. So my apologies. Dr. Tara Shine and Dr. Jessamine Fairfield, thanks so much for joining us. Just to mention that Jessamine's show, We Built This City on Rock and Coal, is on tour at the moment. It's going to Mayo and Donegal over the next couple of weeks. WeBuiltThisCity.ie is the website. It's a great mix of thinking about climate change and comedy, and the shows that Jess puts on are always great fun. She's doing it with a group. Check out WeBuiltThisCity.ie for more details. On the way, is the Earth's core leaking? Stay with us. Yes, this is our weekly science program here on News Talk. It's called Future Proof. My name, as always, is Jonathan McRae. If you like the program, let people know about it. We'd really appreciate it. You can also email us, science@newstalk.com. Now, the Earth's core was thought to be a sealed vault of 3,000 kilometers depth beneath our feet, isolated from the layers above. But new evidence is shaking that assumption to its molten core. Is the Earth's core actually leaking? Well, Professor Matthias Vilbold from the Department of Geochemistry and Isotope Geology at the University of Göttingen in Germany has been exploring this. He joins me now. Welcome to the program, Matthias. This is really, really interesting, because I suppose we often spend our days going about our daily business. We very rarely think about what's very deep beneath our feet. And yet the Earth's core is very important for keeping everything the way it is. So just quickly run through the layers, if you don't mind, and get us to the molten core. So we have the Earth's crust. We're sitting on that, right? That's what we're sitting on. Then underneath that, very quickly, through those layers, how do we get to the molten core in the middle?
Right. So as you rightly said, so the Earth's crust is basically where we stand on, and it's about 50 kilometers thick. And then underneath you have the mantle, which goes down to about 3,000 kilometers roughly. And that is contrary to common beliefs. It's not liquid. Sometimes we see that in some animation. So it's a solid rock, but it can flow basically. And then underneath you have the core, which is basically you have the outer core, which is liquid, and you have the inner core, where the pressures are so high that actually it condenses again. So it is solid. You have the solid core.
Okay, and so is that iron? Is that a solid iron core?
It is a solid iron core. Yes, that's right. So the core is made of iron, and then you have the mantle and the crust. It's made of silicate, different types of silicates. So the mantle is one type of silicate mostly, and the crust is a more silica-rich silicate, basically. Yeah. So that's the distinction.
Okay, and the molten liquid, this ball, is in the center of this liquid ball, right? So underneath the as we start to look at the core, you've got this sort of swimming pool almost of molten liquid, and in the middle is an iron core. Is that iron core? Can we measure anything about that? I mean, is that a perfect sphere, or is it ovoid, or what's the shape of it?
Yeah, it's almost like a perfect sphere. I mean, with some inundations, but I mean, geophysics can actually give us a very clear picture about what the core is actually made of in terms of density, and also in terms of its shape. So we have.
How do we do that? How do we measure something so far deep through so much earth and molten? What is the molten? What is the moat made of? The outer part of the core. What's that made of?
It's also iron, right?
Okay, so it's molten iron and then solid iron in the middle. Okay,
chemically, right. It's very similar. It's just it changes basically from a solid state in the inner core to a liquid state in the outer core.
So is it a gradient then?
It's more or less like a sharp boundary.
Okay. Okay.
Because it happens very quickly that transition. But the way you can learn something about the core in terms of its shape and its state is by looking at earthquake waves that run through the core, through the earth, basically. So seismologists are able to pick up these waves, and they change basically when they pass through different layers of the earth. And these changes are diagnostic of the shape of objects inside the earth, and also the physical state they're in, whether they're molten
or
solid.
So because essentially an earthquake is a wave. And that wave passes through, and how the wave changes will tell you something about the center. And if you have enough earthquake data, you have a pretty good idea of what's in the middle.
That's right. It's pretty much like a sound wave, right? If you listen to sound, it changes, and it's the same principle. It's just running through rocks rather than through the air.
Right. And so this solid iron core in the middle, how big is that?
It's about 1,000 kilometers in about.
Is that all? Okay.
But then the outer core is basically adding to it. But the importance about the core is in a way, because the outer core is liquid, so it can actually move around, and it acts like it creates a magnetic field, right? Pretty much like we have in an electric motor.
This rotation of the ball of iron in the middle creates a magnetic field, because we know that spinning metals, given the right environment, can create magnetic fields, which also can be converted into electricity, as you might know from your childish science. Yeah.
And this is really important if you want to navigate, for instance. We need the magnetic field to... Well, not anymore. We have GPS now, but in the old days, you used it for navigating. But it also it acts like a shield around the Earth, which deflects high energy particles that emanate from the sun. If we wouldn't have that magnetic field, we would be in really trouble, because there would be a higher load of radiogenic energy basically passing all the way through the surface of the Earth, and that would hit us.
Not
really healthy.
people don't realize that this spinning ball of iron in the middle of the earth is what allowed life. It's a unique sort of thing. So this spinning metal, how fast does it spin? And does it spin always in the same direction?
I'm not so sure about the speed, to be honest, because I'm not a seismologist, I'm not a geophysicist. But it does change polarity every now and then. Few hundred thousand years or so, it switches basically, and you can see that when the poles basically start to migrate. So the magnetic pole is not exactly the same as the geographic pole, and it starts wandering, and it can have these inversions, the way you actually switch between north and south. So that happens actually quite frequently on a geological time scale, about a few hundred thousand years or so.
You have done very well indulging my curiosity on subjects that are not your expertise. So thank you. I appreciate that. So let's talk a little bit about your research then, please. The Earth's core, we thought, was very much contained. Research now suggests that might not necessarily be the case. Tell me about your work, please.
Right. So you can picture the core and the mantle that we already established where they are, a bit like water and oil. So if you mix water and oil, they stay separate. And this is basically the image geologists or scientists have in their mind, which is probably true. But the question always was whether there was any chemical exchange between the Earth and the core. I mean, there should be. But because the materials are different, you have metal on the one side and silicate on the other side, it's probably very small and it's very inaccessible. So you don't have access to the core. It's way too deep. So the deepest borehole is about 12 kilometers deep. And compared it to 3,000 kilometers, that's quite a difference, right? But we are in a lucky position that we do have access to samples from that area in the form of volcanic material. Like Hawaii is a very good example because it's well studied, so we know where that material that erupts in Hawaii or on the island of Hawaii comes from. And we assume that it comes from the core mantle boundary. Again, like geophysics, seismic waves basically tell us that this material is rising all the way from the core mantle boundary. So this is the prime location where you would get samples that would allow you to study any core mantle interaction.
Right. So ruptures or fissures in the mantle allow the liquid core to exchange chemicals and travel up through this essentially borehole out, and they come out the volcano.
It's less a rupture. Do you know how a lava lamp looks like? You have these blobs of material that basically rise from the bottom and make their way all the way to the top of the lamp.
Right. Okay.
That's basically the mechanism we think that happens in the mantle. So you have these blobs that originate at the core mantle boundary and make their way all the way to the surface. But again, it's the type of material that comes from this location. And so people have studied these rocks in terms of how can we find any evidence for core mantle interaction. They've used different types of geochemical and isotopic evidence. And there were some really good indications, but there was always an alternative way of interpreting the data. As it's always in science, you have multiple opinions, you have multiple models. And it never has been so. It was always a bit ambiguous. And so one way of testing that was basically by looking at ruthenium isotopes. That's what we did.
Ruthenium. What is ruthenium?
Ruthenium is a precious metal. So you have gold, you have palladium, for instance, you have platinum, you have also rhenium, osmium, and ruthenium is also like a one of these precious metals. It's a kind of group geochemically. It's a group of elements that behave very similarly.
Yeah,
and also very rare, because hence they are called precious metals. And so we started looking at this type of tracer. And the problem is, because it is really rare in the crust and in the mantle, it's really hard to analyze because there's so little of it.
Hmm.
So we did some method development that took most part of the project to get the method right. And in the end, actually found that signal that showed us that there is indeed some interaction between the core and the mantle.
So you now know that there is this sort of exchange of chemicals and material from the core, which is what, 3,000 kilometers down. Is that what you said?
Yeah.
Yeah. And that is, it's traveling this extraordinary journey to get to the surface by hijacking the highway of a volcano. Why is that of interest? What can we learn from that about the geophysics of the planet? And why is that of interest? I mean, it's not, we shouldn't worry about it, right? It doesn't imply any volatility. So why is it important?
Well, it's important in terms of a more general picture of how the Earth functions. Right. So I said that seismics basically tell us something about the inner parts of the mantle. But if you take it's almost like a photo which is not really in focus. There's always a bit of a haze if you look at seismic data. And so the geochemical data or the isotopic data that we now add to that allows us to sharpen that image. So we really know that there's material coming from the core mantle boundary all the way to the top. And that tells us something about how dynamic the inner part of the Earth is. So you have huge amounts of rocks and volumes of rocks that are shifted around inside the Earth over geological time.
Mm.
And this is really important for us because it tells us that we sort of know that, but it tells us that Earth is a living planet. So there's still energy in that planet that creates volcanism, that produces water, because most of the water that we have comes from the inside of the Earth. And if you com- compared it to other planets in the solar system, for instance, Mars or the moon, which isn't really a planet, but it's a planetary object, they are basically dead. They don't have that anymore. And the temperature is really low. We can't actually live there because they are dead planets.
Right. Okay. And this sort of activity or life, if you're thinking about the opposite of death, this life presumably plays a part in our climate, in the functionality of the planet. I mean, if we didn't have this sort of exchange of chemicals from the core to the surface, do you think that we would be living on a very different planet?
Definitely, yes. So if you look at the current discussion about climate change, I mean, it's well known that if you go back through Earth's history, we did have multiple episodes where climate changed for various reasons. The difference is that the time scale is really short now compared to geological time scales in the past. I think this is the problem now because it happens so quickly these days. But if you go back, there were times where the Earth was completely frozen. We had a complete ball of it's called snowball Earth. And how do you get out of this system? And this is where actually the inner dynamics of our planets came into play. Hmm. Because we have these dynamic Earths, you also had crust, like plates that are being subducted underneath other plates. And all the carbon that's stored in these plates all became extracted and entered the atmosphere. And we created basically a warm house again.
Yeah.
So what we do artificially or human-made today, putting lots of CO2 in the atmosphere and warming up the Earth, happened on a natural scale, on a larger scale, over much longer time scales in the past. And that led us out of the snowball Earth scenario. If we wouldn't have that, we would basically live in on a snowball rather than a moderate climate.
Yeah, and I suppose it's not something that we, obviously geologists work on, you know, time frames of millions of years often. And when you see animations of rocks over that period of time, you realize that the Earth is a very exciting and moving and dynamic place, but on a human timescale, it perhaps seems less so. Really interesting speaking with you, and thank you so much for joining us. That is Professor Matthias Vilbolt from the University of Göttingen. Thanks, Matthias.
Thank you for the invitation.
That is it from us on this week's program. Thanks to Marisa Sullivan, Rory Galvin, and Hugo da Silva Scott on sound. Thank you for listening. We'll be back with more Future Proof in your podcast feed on Tuesday. In the meantime, stay curious.
Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland.
Sundays from midday on News Talk.